This podcast is sponsored by AAA, the American Automobile Association. AAA members get discounts on tickets, resort accommodations, and more at Walt Disney World and other Orlando attractions. If you book a qualifying Walt Disney World resort vacation package at select AAA offices, you'll receive a free subscription to touringplans.com and dedicated trip planning resources just for AAA clients. Go to AAA.com or ask your local AAA travel agent for more details on this offer. All right, it's another beautiful day here in downtown Orlando. I'm at Universal Studios with Jim Hill. This is another edition of the Unofficial Guide to Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. Jim, welcome to Universal Studios Orlando.
Yeah, nice to be back here.
It's nice. So we just walked through the entrance turnstiles, a very very Disney-esque experience, all the way from the greeting to the ticket prices.
Well, yeah, that's, again, the complimentary defibrillator for those of you who's like, how much for 2 days? You know, two park, 1 day.
So it's $120 per adult to get in for 1 day for two parks. Huh? So,
good Lord.
All right, so where are we at now, Jim? We're walking down a street here. We've got
the Stars, and we have our option of going up, I believe that's Hollywood Boulevard there. Rodeo Drive. But directly across the way here is, you know, it's kind of interesting. Universal now actually has characters of its own. It doesn't have to license. And this is the Despicable Me redo of, started off life as the Hanna-Barbera ride and then became, you know, the Jimmy Neutron Nicktoon Blast. And this is actually, it's been the home of some really fun simulator attractions. And the word on Despicable Me is it's going to be as fun, if not more fun. But
really,
this is Gru's house they're building outside here. You are going to go into, you know, Gru's house and into his lair and hang out with the minions. It's going to be very, very cool.
So this is the building, the first, I guess, main show building that you see on the left-hand side, stage 42, mm-hmm. as you're going down the street. One of the things I noticed about the street, too, is that it's not organized in a way similar to, say, Main Street. There is no camera shop. There's no camera shop, you know, stuff that you need for your day coming up on the right.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. In fact, what's interesting about Universal is right from the get-go, in fact, when Sid Sheinberg put this project into the works, this was a working movie studio that people could visit. So the idea was, I mean, for example, you look here at Rodeo Drive. The road curves, so, you know, that you have a way to take shots here without it looking like, wait a minute, you're trying to fake California in Florida. I mean, and what's kind of interesting is, of course, they've since stepped away from that idea. So, you know, but they're still clinging, the design of the park itself still keys off of that. So, here you see, it's not the cute little Disney buildings, you know, it's full size facades.
You know, sorry, two stories pretty much everywhere. Again, sort of a big Hollywood 1930s theme to this.
But what's fascinating, again, is because both Disney and Universal, in fact, the kind of controversial aspect of the history of this project was that Michael Eisner, when he was the head of Paramount, actually in 81, when Universal bought the land to build this place in 79. They spent $13 million on a chunk of land here.
Wow.
But they were, in fact, really what's kind of bizarre is they, if Lou Wasserman had been willing to pay $50,000 more in 1976, he could have had SeaWorld.
For $50,000?
It was literally the bid. It was one of these situations where Sid didn't like to bid. He made a price, and SeaWorld came back and said, we have another buyer, and can you bump up your bid a bit? And it's like, I don't bump up bids. And so that's how SeaWorld went to Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch. And, you know, Lou regretted that for the rest of his life. That, you know,
50 grand.
Anyway, just a quick note again. There's such duplication of effort. I mean, again,
We're walking past Universal's version of the Brown Derby restaurant.
But this is
Brown Derby hat shop. Sorry, Jim.
But again, there were two Brown Derby restaurants in Hollywood, and this was the more goofy design, and this is the one that Universal grabbed.
It's an actual hat.
Yep.
So we're walking down. This is Rodeo Drive.
Yep.
Again, you've got the sort of a 1930s, 1940s feel to it. The road curves to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And then runs parallel to the other road, it looks like.
But again, it's just fascinating to watch how they use the same playbook. I mean, again, going with, Disney Hollywood Studios has the camera shop and that sort of thing. And here we're walking by Schwab's, drugstore, famous for supposedly where Lana Turner got discovered. Well, anyway, to get to the controversial story, what ends up happening is that Eisner's at Paramount, they're looking for financial partners, and they have a meeting in 1981 that to this day Michael Eisner swears he wasn't at. But
Eisner's at a meeting that he swears he wasn't at. All right.
But the other people in the room said, look, it was the Jack Webb building. I remember he was across the table from me. He asked a lot of questions, and a lot of informed questions about what was going into this park. Mm-hmm. And so now, jump ahead 84, Michael Eisner is now in charge of, the Walt Disney Company. And in 85, he announces, hey, we're doing a studio. And Universal was like, what? And there was this weird moment, because they knew that Eisner knew all of their plans.
He'd seen it a couple years ago.
Yeah. And more to the point, Lou was still kind of, well, do we not? Do we do this? And what ends up happening is Universal actually reaches out to Disney and says, okay, we know you're meeting with other studios because you need things for the studio. How about we go in together? We'll do the Disney Universal Studio attraction. And, Disney sort of walks around it, kicks the tires, and then opts to go with MGM. Because, again, as we talked about, MGM...
$100,000.
Yeah, it's like, it's cheaper in the long run.
How long did it take them to say yes to that MGM thing? Were they like, yeah, we'll get back to you in a week? Or was it, okay, I'll sign that deal right now.
But
you're the junior assistant to the janitor. Look, I know we're good here.
That's right. Just grab the paperwork. But again, talk about duplication effort. We have the dark room.
And it's the same sort of same sort of look to the dark room. It's got the same sort of font, I think. It's bigger here than... No. In studios, it's one story, right?
It's the Disney went with the intimate scale to replicate Disneyland, and Universal went with full scale because they were planning on shooting movies here.
Oh wow, that's really interesting. So this is their main street.
Yep.
But interestingly, you don't directly walk on it.
No.
Entering the park, it's sort of off to the right.
There is so much counterintuitive design here, and again, the theme park people bumped up against the studio people left and right here, because it's sort of like, well, where can we put our attractions? Well, really, really deep in the park. And, it's like, but people need, where's the weenie? What draws them in?
Yeah.
And in the case of their main drag there, the Plaza of the Stars, their weenie was literally a dimensional flat of the New York Public Library.
Well, that draws me to New York.
Right there. I want a book.
Speaking of weenie, it's really interesting. So we're at the end of the end of the street where it intersects with a couple of things, and I'm looking around. I really can't see any icon that jumps out that says walk towards me.
No, and that again, you will see.
It's like the Animal Kingdom when you're not looking at the Tree of Life.
Okay, this will change when we get over to Islands Adventure. That was designed from day one to be a really for real theme park. You're going to constantly bump heads here.
We're walking past the horror makeup show. Is that still going on?
It tends to be done on a seasonal basis. Though I noticed that we have an 11:30 start time over there.
Oh, there you go.
Okay, it's back. For a while there they updated that, and now it really does sort of hinge off of the classic Universal monsters.
Oh, good.
But anyway, let's walk down to the lagoon where they're about to do what were you calling it? The Fantastic Illusions
World of Color.
There we go.
Of color.
Okay, so
this is where they do it.
Well, yeah. Then now, when the park initially opened, they had a Miami Vice stunt show kind of a
thing.
That's exactly. Racing up and down, the lagoon here. And now, again, they're looking to do, based off of the fact that this is literally the Universal Studios' 100th year of operation. This is a nighttime show that's going to have, all sorts of tribute to all of these genres that Universal has made movies of. But this will at least give you a sense of, here's same thing, same visual confusion. Where would you want to go, Len?
So we sort of stepped down into the area right in front of the lagoon. To our right is Bull's Gym, a Walgreens Drugs, and
they're New York area.
Area.
Now feeding over into San Francisco. For example, the Girardelli building.
Right.
But really there's nothing here that says walk towards me. It looks like it's just an endless series of city streets. You can kind of see some show buildings back to the right a little bit, but it looks industrial. It doesn't. That's really interesting. But again, I'm not saying it's bad.
There are some amazing attractions hidden. I mean, for example, walking down the street that we just came down, did you notice that the Terminator 2 3D attraction was back there?
No, didn't notice it at all.
Yeah. I mean, literally, it's...
Really? Down the street that we walked down?
We walked by, one of their big, large marquee attractions, and you walk right by it.
Didn't even see it.
Yeah.
Didn't even see it.
So, I mean,
it's... Wow.
And that's a problem. It kind of makes me crazy because Universal does have all these wonderful attractions that, when you're in the park, it's like, well, wait a minute. You're constantly consulting the map because the building is dressed as an actual set. In fact, if we walk out to the road here, so you can probably see the sign just sticking up.
This is great. Jim and I are looking for the Terminator 2 sign.
Oh, there you go. See the recessed marquee there, T2 3D, toward the end of the street, right there at the turn.
Yeah, you got to be kidding me.
No.
Yeah, we'd never find that.
But that's it. That's it exactly.
Wow. I mean, props for making the thing look like a city street, but geez, that's tough to find. All right, so we're walking past Carmen's Veranda.
And again.
Carmen's Veranda, get it? the cast member should have a fruit on their head.
Now, this is their Central Park area. Typically for Halloween Horror Nights, they'll redress this. It's actually, with the trees hanging over, very atmospheric, and they'll typically throw a maze in over here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice. It's a good place for a maze. They've got wrought iron, black wrought iron fences. They've got a bunch of trees, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I guess these trees do pretty well in the Florida, climate. Yeah.
But again, the idea was to, you chose trees that sold the idea of New York Central Park or a park, against the lake. And
this is really pretty. This isn't bad at all.
Now we start to get back into attractions, okay?
All right, so now we're walking back towards, we've ended the California area. We're back towards Animal Actors?
Yep. Right in front of us is the Animal Actors stage. Okay. This was an opening day attraction. And actually, off to the right here, we start to get into the stuff that they were really hoping would drive the bus. The E.T. adventure. One of the things that Universal, right off the get-go, what they wanted was to be different from Disney. And one of the ways they chose to be different from Disney is they cut a deal with Steven Spielberg in '87. Okay. And what ended up happening was that Steven, for any attraction that he consulted on, got a very large fee. I mean, an incredibly large fee. Mm-hmm. As in, he gets 5% of the gate here.
Really?
Again,
5%.
5%.
So I just gave Steven Spielberg $6. $12 for two tickets.
But it gets worse than that. He gets 5% of the plush. He gets 5% of the food. He gets 5% of everything.
Wow. All right. That's a deal.
Now, this area isn't opening for a bit yet, but you can see the Universal attraction back there. Massive attraction. Still does have a somewhat problematic ride system in that you are literally riding the bikes from the movie.
Really?
But it has one of the most amazing queues. You literally go in, and you're in a pine forest. And again, you got to understand, this opened in 1990. You walk inside, it's dark, and they pumped in the pine scent, and you're making your way along woodland trails. And it's, to be honest, the queue is, I think, better than the attraction. Because then, you end up being threatened by FBI agents. Your bicycle then flies to E.T.'s planet, which evidently rents out to the kids from Small World. It's very cute, but the big deal, at least initially with this attraction, is they pretended you're going onto a set, and so you're going to need an ID.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point in the attraction, you walked up to somebody and said, hello, my name is Len, and they type it in, they hand you a pass, and they say, give this to the attendant. And then at the end of the ride, as you're leaving, last scene, here's an E.T. audio animatronic, And he's like, goodbye, Len. Nice. You know, and just names off everybody in your car. And one of the other attractions that this park was famous for was Back to the Future, the ride. Mm-hmm. And again, another Spielberg thing, another nice check for Steven. But this came on the heels of Star Tours. In fact, it was kind of interesting that Spielberg, you know, literally talked about, you know, hey, I went over with George and I rode Star Tours and that's cool. And couldn't we do something like that with Back to the Future? And it's like, okay. And
was there a simulator ride that I missed in the story to Back to the Future? I guess there's the car, but...
Well, that's... Yeah, actually, you literally got in the DeLorean. In fact, that was what was genuinely charming about this, where as opposed to getting on, you know, the Star Tours Star Speeder, mm-hmm. where there's 30 or 40 of you, with this one, you literally got into the DeLorean. There were eight of you. It was so intimate, you know. Oh. And the way they compensated, it was an Omnimax dome with, four cars on three different levels, two different domes. So to anyone,
24 cars 24, times eight.
Yeah, I mean...
So they're moving people that way.
It was an absolute, it ate people. Yeah. And, you know, the sad thing is, again, this being the way this industry works... Over time, it just, you know, it lost popularity. Uh-huh. And so now we have The Simpsons. And
that's right. We're walking up on the Simpsons land right now. We're passing the Quickie Mart, the iconic Quickie
and
Mart.
You seriously have not done this ride yet?
No.
Oh, okay. We're going to pause here for a moment because Len has to do this ride. This is the meanest, funniest ride. It's an equal opportunity offender. It actually goes after Disney, Universal, and SeaWorld.
Awesome. So, all right, we're gonna pause here at the end of the street while we go on the Simpsons ride. We'll see you guys in a minute. All right, this is Len and Jim. We're back. We've just been on the Simpsons ride at Universal, which I've got to say is hysterical. The queue alone with all of the Simpsons characters and all of the jokes, especially the theme park jokes, the queue alone is worth a 30-minute wait just to see all of the jokes in the queue. The ride is a typical simulator. Simulators make me a little queasy, but it's really well done. There are probably 100 in-jokes in there.
Oh, absolutely.
In the ride, but it was really, really well done. I really liked the queue quite a bit.
And again, as a theme park, if you're a theme park buff, I mean, just the stuff they do, for example, in Captain Dinosaur Pirate Ripoff Ride, if you're paying attention there, they duplicate the exact set of from Disney's Pirates of the Caribbean ride. The gimmick is you go backwards through it. You actually start at the auction scene, go under the bridge, and come up to the pirate ship. But again, if you just... You know, they turned it around and figured, okay, that's enough. That'll satisfy the legal department. The interesting thing, though, is this was not the first version of the ride. You remember how Maggie becomes, you know, giant mutated creature destroying Springfield?
Yeah.
That's a carryover from the first version of the ride. The initial version was actually, it was going to be Bring Your Family to Work Day at Mr. Burns' nuclear plant. And, you know, you were going to be riding around on kind of a Pargo and you know, have this... And then eventually, you know, from the Springfield nuclear power plant, bust out into the town, you know, pursuing Maggie. And what ended up happening is while everybody else agreed to come on board for this project, Harry Shearer didn't. And he's the voice of Mr. Burns. And it was basically one of these situations where I'm willing to do it if you pay me more money. And eventually it was like, just everybody else was coming in at one fee and everyone else was happy to be on board here. And Harry every so often gets obstinate this way. And so it was like, okay, well, then we'll just do a Mr. Burns free. You know, in fact, you do get to see Mr. Burns briefly in like the last moments of the attraction. He and Smithers go by in a hot air balloon, but he never actually talks.
And that's why?
That's why. So, But again, it's this is, you know, they deliberately packed as many jokes as they could into it. And just to be clear here, this was actually written by the writers of The Simpsons. They work was done on this attraction during the writers' strike, and they were thrilled to be able to take advantage of it. So
it's during their downtime they were able to throw in jokes for the.
Yep.
That's great.
So, and again, I can't quite wrap my head around the idea. You haven't done. Men in Black, Alien Attack?
Oh, I've done Men in Black.
Okay, so yeah. You understand the... again...
Yeah, it's sort of a Buzz Lightyear-esque in the thing.
No, very much so. But,
yeah.
But that coupled with, you know, between great theme park jokes, you know, in fact, you know, again, constantly riffing on Disney.
Oh, yeah.
And even, you know, duplicating the towers here from the 1964 New York World's Fair.
Yeah, this is actually a pretty well-done pavilion here. So we're walking up on the Men in Black pavilion. It's definitely got that retro future look to it with arches and sort of angular architecture. Where the signage and the plants are all sort of what people thought landscaping was going to look like in the 1960s. It's very well done. The signage actually matches the design of the landscaping. It's pretty good. And of course, CNC Music Factory, of course, was one of the things that you had to see in the Back in the Future.
Very cool. But now you understand about the multiple ends for this attraction?
Yes.
All right. That, you know, there literally is an end where you do become a Men in Black.
I don't know if I ever got to that point.
Well, you know, that you, if you've actually achieved a high enough score for this, what happens is that the Will Smith character congratulates you, tells you, you know, pick up your suit, and then a screen lights up, and it's an audio animatronic tailor who's like, it'll be ready Tuesday, come back. So.
That's great. So we're coming up on, what area are we walking into?
You will notice they didn't kid around about Jaws. That's gone.
Oh, so we're looking at straight ahead, Fear Factor's on our right. I guess that was Amity.
Yep.
Was straight ahead, but now it's nothing.
Yeah, and more to the point, you can actually see the piles of earth that they've dug up. They've dug out, you know, that, you know, that what is it, 75 tons of concrete that made the lagoon.
Wow.
So, this project, I mean, for a project that they haven't officially announced yet, Universal is moving at warp speed on this thing.
What is the project?
This is going to be Diagon Alley. This is going to be, they're splitting Harry Potter across the two parks.
Oh, really?
Yep. This is not a drill. When you come here, back here in 3 years, mm-hmm. This will be, in fact, if the stories are true, you will be able to enter through the Leaky Cauldron. They'll actually do the wall opening. And inside, they'll have all of the shops, you know, where Harry would go to get his books. And, mm-hmm. you know, but more to the point, the Gringotts coaster that, you know, was used to in the final film of the series where you went down deep in the... In fact, it was used in the first film as well. Mm-hmm. It's their new thrill ride. You're going to...
Really?
Yeah. But yeah, they weren't kidding around. This thing closed on January 2nd. By January 3rd, these construction walls were up.
Wow.
And they have been tearing it down ever since. So,
yeah, there's a lot of infrastructure that went in for Jaws, because it had been there since, well, for a long time, right?
Oh, yeah. No, and in fact, it was kind of how this park got its reputation, and not necessarily a good one, when it opened in June of 1990. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, the whole notion of, we're doing different rides. We're doing rougher. We're doing tougher. And, you know, so Ride and Show, the company that built the thing, ended up... they got the stuff loaded in, but they didn't have enough time to do tests and adjust. And so when the park opened up, Jaws didn't work. King Kong really didn't work all that efficiently. Earthquake didn't work. And on opening day... Your three major attractions that people are seeing on billboards as they drive into the park aren't working.
Wow. Yeah, we noted this in the unofficial guide that Universal went with, because there were new rides, they went with new technology behind the rides. And to your point, I guess they didn't have time for a test and adjust.
And it bit them in the butt. In fact, you know, that was the most famous image from the opening day of Universal in June of 1990. People standing in front of the ticket booth screaming for their money back. And, you know... Thankfully, again, that was before the age of cell phones, so it was just, it made the nightly news, but it was hard for Universal to sort of reinvent itself, to put that, you know, reputation to bed. And but, you know, now, you know, I think if you look at the attractions that they brought into the parks, they have tried significantly in each case to improve.
Yeah.
Now, what's kind of interesting, we're coming up here... And this is...
We're walking towards the Amity Island Lobster and Smoked Fish Tower.
Now, back on the other side of this, though, is what used to be the earthquake attraction. It's now known as Disaster.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the really interesting component of the Harry Potter expansion. And evidently, it will be basically Phase 3. Phase 1... was, you know, Hogwarts Castle and, you know, over in Islands. Phase 2 will be Diagon Alley. Phase 3 will be the Hogwarts Express.
Really?
And
the train.
The plan is they're actually going to link the two parks. And you're going to be able to ride the Hogwarts Express in both directions, two different ride experiences.
Wow, really?
Yep. You know, Universal is not kidding, but... This is
really going to become the Harry Potter park.
Well, you know, face it. You know, that Harry Potter has been such a game changer for Universal between the way attendance is surged at the parks and merchandise sales are just straight through the roof.
Oh, that's great.
So why not give them another place to shop and, you know, why not give them the experience they really wanted to have, which is, again, they want to go to Diagon Alley. They want to ride the Gringotts coaster and they want to ride the Hogwarts Express. So Universal is like, if you're willing to come here... and pay $120 a day for a two-park hopper, absolutely.
Absolutely. We will give you what you want.
That's right. So, anyway.
So we're walking down a street now. Does this street have a name? It looks like San Francisco?
Yep. We are now officially in San Francisco.
Okay.
It's an interesting bit of Universal history here. This is Lombard's Landing. This is their great seafood restaurant. In fact, Nemo fans always like to go here because of the ornamentation, sort of the steampunk interior of the place.
Mm.
But it's 1995, and I'm here at the park with my ex and David Mumford, the late Imagineer.
Mm-hmm.
And David wanted to come here because, again, he'd heard about the Nemo theming. And, you know, I get up to go use the restroom, and the downstairs restrooms are shut down for some reason. They said, go upstairs. And the problem is the restrooms aren't really clearly designated upstairs, so I opened the wrong door, and... here's a room on, you know, on a boardroom table is the model of the yet-to-be-announced expansion, the $3 billion expansion of the Universal Orlando Resort. And I sort of stand there and goggle for a moment and go back down and, you know, explain to David. Again, David the Imagineer.
Yeah.
You know, like, what? And again, David was such an honorable guy. You know, it was one of these things where he's like, he went with me up to the second floor of the restaurant, but could not. It's like, I can't. If they catch me, I'll lose my job. I can't look in.
Yeah,
and so he stood with his back to the wall while I opened the door, looked at it, and said, "What do you see?
I see amazing things."
You know, but it was literally the design that we know today between the two giant parking structures, the hotels that, you know, sort of tee off of the, you know, coupled by the new park side by side. But again, what was weird is that wasn't Islands. That was the first iteration of Universal's...
Oh, really?
That was Tooniversal Park.
Tooniversal.
Well, you see, the thing of it was is that Universal, you know, they'd been working here in Florida for 5 years, and they kind of hit a plateau as to how many guests would come, and they realized, you know, by going with all the rough, scary rides, we haven't got the kids, and so we need to build a companion park that is strictly for kids. So it was... And again, another one of these, you know, there but for the grace of God. They cut a deal with Warner Brothers. And for, you know, they were going to get the rights to the entire library of DC characters. So we're talking Batman, we're talking Superman.
Wow.
And they also were going to get the rights to all the Warner Brothers characters, the Looney Tunes, the Tiny Tunes. And they literally designed this entire park where, you know, when you walked in where Marvel Island is now... Mm-hmm. was Metropolis, Batman, and you had, you know, the Hulk coaster was the Superman coaster.
Wow.
And to your right, where Seuss's Landing is, you have, you have Gotham City and Dark and, you know, with, you know, thrill rides based around the Joker and the Penguin and all that. And then across the way, you know, you literally are looking out at Looney Tune Land. And actually, you had one of my favorite attractions on the planet that never got built. It was the Roadrunner roller coaster. And had the greatest launch sequence on the planet. You literally made your way through the queue, which of course is, you know, desert and canyon and this sort of thing.
Right.
And you get on board a giant Acme rocket. And, you know, so now it's launch time. And so what happens? That it's time to launch. They hit a button, and a giant audio animatronic of Wile E. Coyote leans out with a sparkler and lights the firework. And then, whoosh, you're off. But anyway, so everyone looks at it and is like, wow, this is amazing. Oh, we got to make this park. And it's like, cool. It's time for the negotiation. And what Warner Brothers wanted, and this, again, all they wanted was a one-time fee for the theme park rights into perpetuity for all of these characters. They wanted $40 million.
A one-time payment of $40
million. $40
million.
And Sid Sheinberg balked. It was like, 40? No. And
$40 million.
$40 million.
This is what year?
This was, I want to say, 93, 94.
Okay.
And, you know, in the end, it's just, then they did all of this design work and, you know, built it, you know, it all around this Toon Lagoon. And, you know, they come in, well, we lost Warner's. But we do have this movie we're making with dinosaurs. Can you do anything with that? And, you know, again, it was just this sort of systematic thing of, okay, take out Looney Tune land, put in Jurassic Park land, and on and on and on. So
we're walking towards the end of, I guess, the San Francisco. No, we're still on San Francisco theme, right?
Well, we're transitioning here into New York.
Oh, so then, but the interesting thing to me, there's an actual Starbucks coffee here in the intersection, in the corner.
Well, you know,
I'm okay with it.
They're like cockroaches. You know, you leave your car door open for 5 minutes, they'll put one in there. So
this is the New York street area, and it's the first impression they get from it is much bigger than the Streets of America. So there's actually 1, 2, 3, 4 story buildings. Right. They've got actual telephone poles with actual wires. It's, I mean, it's got actual, you know, it's got actual things in it, like a real Starbucks, a real Ben and Jerry's, things that you would see, not in 1940s New York, but you know, things that you'd see on a typical city street.
Now, and again, to just sort of point out how counterintuitive this is, we're going to duck down this alley. I mean, right here,
all right,
off of the street.
It's the, there's an alley to the left that contains a pawn shop. Actually, Jim, it'd be better if they put the pawn shop near the entrance so you could pay for the... This is in the alley. Wow, this thing goes way back.
That's what I mean. And but again, you can see this was designed to be an event, you know, a venue where films are actually shot. Though interestingly, for Halloween Horror Night, they do make use of this space. So
we're going way back into an alley here. Yep. So we're at the point now in the alley. Oh, they've got actual doorways and everything here. We actually don't see any other people in the theme park. We're back to this far in an alley, and it's the back end of the New York alley. It's dark brick. It goes up a full three stories, and there's other stuff behind it. But it's got what looks like a working sort of fire escape. It's got windows and doors, and it's fully detailed. It's not like they just stopped with the detailing when they got far back where people wouldn't see it. It's got some pretty ornate brickwork. It's got arches.
Think about this. You know, compare this to what we just saw yesterday, we were at Disney Hollywood Studios.
Yeah, this is much more elaborate.
No, totally. But again, always intended as a real place to shoot real movies. And it just curves around here.
And it keeps going. Look at that.
So you create all of these spaces where...
This would be great for photography.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, again, the irony is that because of what happened here in Florida, where it stopped being... You know, they really stopped filming films here because it became that much easier to do blue screen and get a green screen.
This is amazingly well detailed, and they've kept it up too.
No, that's it exactly. I mean, even the textures of the pavements and, you know, painting the individual cobblestones. Now, what's weird though is that they have started using this as show space. In fact, if you come over here in the afternoon, this street right here is where they do the Blues Brothers show.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right on the stoops here. So
this is great.
But at the same time, I mean, you know, for example, look at the textured paper we got here, which makes this absolutely miserable for anybody who's in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
So
they've got sidewalks for that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, this is really, really interesting. What's the train over there?
Well, that's actually what's left over from Back to the Future. That is actually the Emmett Brown. That used to sit outside of the Back to the Future attraction. And you've got the DeLorean there. In fact, what's interesting is during the day, I guess Emmett's on break. But, you know, typical they'll have a Doc Brown lurking there so you can get your picture taken.
Oh, great.
So, anyway, so what do you want to do here?
Which way?
We could go up here toward Mummy.
Let's do that.
So, anyway, Mummy is the replacement for King Kong Confrontation, which... And again, what's weird about King Kong Confrontation was that, in a lot of ways, this is one of the things that came out of the plans being shown to Michael Eisner. Because, again, they were going to really do a clone of Universal Studios Hollywood. A lot of this park was going to be tram tour, and you're going to roll through buildings and have experiences. But when they saw the plans, you know, for what Disney was planning on doing, and it had a tram tour, it's like, oh, we got to do something different. And creative officer here at Universal, Bob Ward, came up with a very interesting idea. It was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, we have Jaws in the tram tour. We have Earthquake in the tram tour. We have King Kong on our tram tour to Hollywood. Why don't we just bust those elements out and make them individual attractions? I mean, literally. And it's like, what if, you know, again, let's do something brave for Universal. Let's not have a tram tour. And it was like, and that was, that literally drove the development of this park.
It's like, makes sense. It seems like it worked for them. I mean.
So, of course, the irony is for the first 18 months of the park, it did have a tram tour, you know, but it just drove you around through all of these environments going, look at our amazing backlot.
Wow.
No, I mean, again, the guys at Universal really are, I know Disney has great publicity, but the guys at Universal are incredibly clever as well. I mean, take, for example, the coaster we're coming up on here.
All right.
You know, Rip Ride Rocket. This was a coaster that was built. This is literally straddling, you know, the center line of the park, all right?
Right.
Not only that, it backs up against all of the sound stages they still use. It sits on top of main plumbing and electrical. And they were able to build this thing without once disrupting operations of the park. There was only one night where after all the guests had left that they had to dig down and do electrical. But again, this is, you know, cutting over facades that have been here forever. It goes, you know, you've got your Twister attraction here that never stopped running.
Wow.
It's an impressive feat of, you know, civic planning. You know, the amount of planning that went into this to make sure that it happened without disrupting the park.
That's really interesting because the coaster track goes above, behind, and through many of the buildings that we're looking at.
Yep. And in fact, as we walk up here, this is, this was supposed to be your icon for the park. This was, you know, you've got the Guggenheim, the Museum of Modern Art, you know, and then right beyond that was your New York Public Library. And I think that was, yep, there you go. You can see it right there.
The New York Public Library. Oh, yes, right here. Oh, it is iconic. It's pretty big.
But again, is that enough to drive you deep into the park?
No, I don't know that I would have seen it from way back there. No, I don't think I would have seen it.
But again, the irony, I guess, is that, again, all theme parks change out attractions. And one of the things they lost out on was their original Ghostbuster attraction, which was, up until that time, the biggest Pepper Ghost show on the planet. You literally sat in the theater and they recreated the end of the first Ghostbusters film. The top of the building, and I mean, literally to the point of, I mean, this is Landmark Entertainment put together, but they actually did the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man's head and hand came up.
Really?
Oh, it was killer. Oh, it was killer.
Awesome.
But, though, interestingly enough, again, because Disney and Universal were, you know, in direct competition for a lot of this stuff, you know, an early version of the Great Movie Ride actually did feature a Ghostbusters scene. And yeah, I mean, the Imagineers had it designed. You were going to roll through it. You know, they were, you know, again, you know, same thing, Pepper's Ghost. But in the end, Universal won the negotiation, and they got those characters from Columbia.
Huh.
So,
we're walking up right now on the Twister attraction. Have you done this?
Yeah. It has some very neat effects, but the perhaps the neatest effect of the film, if you're watching in the pre-show, Helen Hunt, and I'm blanking the name of the gentleman who stars with her in Twister. It was a very, very difficult shoot. By the end of the shoot, they hated one another.
Awesome.
And so now it came time to do the theme park attraction. And, you know, it was something that was mentioned in their contracts. Mm-hmm. And Helen had said, look, I will do this, but I don't want to be anywhere near Bill. All right. And so literally what's fascinating is if you're paying attention during the show, they don't even appear on the same monitors. You know, it's like Helen's on one monitor, Bill's on the other monitor. And, you know, and they do interact, but, you know, they shot on different days. And, okay, this is what Helen says, that bitch, you know. So.
It's an interesting attraction because you actually get a vortex.
That's it, exactly.
Built inside,
exactly.
Inside the attraction. So mm-hmm. It's like a two-story room. And there's a huge cage around it. You don't get really, really close to it. But they actually create a miniature cyclone inside the attraction.
Absolutely. And what's the other thing, I was taking a tour here with an employee once, and he said, you know, all right, try to open this door. The show's on. And it's literally, you'd have to be Bronco Nagurski to pull against, you know. So, anyway, we're coming up on the Universal Classic Monsters Cafe, and you know, Universal has struggled to find ways to bring the monsters into this park.
Frankenstein.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, they're a proud part of their heritage, but they just can't. You know, this is as close as they get something to work at a restaurant, and it has some wonderful posters and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. but just not, you know, the success they hope for. On the other hand, you know, right across here we have their Show Bowl. And, you know, this has proved to be, you know, a hugely popular facility for them. So much so...
What is it?
Well, this is where, you know, for example, during a Mardi Gras promotion, this coming Saturday, the Goo Goo Dolls will be playing here. This, you know, just past Saturday, Diana Ross was here. But this used to be actually where they had their Boneyard. Huh. You know, you could come and see, you know, props from, you know, Jaws and that sort of thing. But now it's been created as a show space. And, again, not used every day of the week, but... You come here on a Saturday, and that'll be full of people. The streets here will be full of people, you know, all watching that concert. So,
great, you know, it's a good use of space.
No, absolutely,
it's a nice theater space. There's no seating, but it's wide open. It's a, you know, it's sort of an amphitheater you'd see at maybe a small town.
No, you know, absolutely. But more to the point, what's clever about the planning? Notice that you have your show bowl, your stage, and the coaster. This was built at the same time as the coaster.
Uh huh. And, oh, there's a roller coaster, by the way, two loops right behind, or a giant drop and a loop right behind.
Rocket. And what's fascinating is that the roller coaster actually operates during the concerts. So
when Diana Ross is doing a slow sort of song.
Well, I would imagine for Miss Ross, they'll turn it off. But no, it's, again, I just, what I like about Universal is, if they're number two in the market, they're a really scrappy, smart number two.
Yeah.
And now with Potter and again things like Despicable Me,
yeah,
you know, they're getting good about, you know, crafting things that people genuinely want to see.
That's great.
So
how much when they well, we'll talk about Harry Potter when we get over there. How much does it cost them for something like Despicable Me now? Is it easier for them to get those kinds of film rights now that they've done well with Potter?
Well, I mean, again, you got to remember, Despicable Me is theirs. All right.
Yeah, but okay, so that's a bad example. But in general.
But for example, we're here in front of Shrek. They did have to pay pretty dearly to DreamWorks, but they got with that. They got the rights to put the Shrek characters in the park. They also got the rights to bring other DreamWorks characters to the park. In fact, if you're walking around, some days you'll get the characters from Madagascar. You'll get the characters from, you know, the penguins of Madagascar.
Yep. So I love the penguins.
Yep. Anyway, I think we're actually coming up on your lounge if you want to check that out.
Oh, the American Express lounge that you get access to if you pay with your American Express card. All right, let's take a break. We'll take a water break here, and we'll be back in a minute with more coverage. All right, we're back after our little water break. We've walked back down the main street towards the entrance. Jim, when does Rip Ride Rocket? What's the name of that? You mentioning something about Rip Ride Rocket as we were walking past that little anecdote, a little story?
Well, there's actually two that again give you both an example of the good side of Universal and the bad side of Universal. The key to Rip Ride Rocket is that you can actually pick the song selection. You know, that you can, you know, your onboard music, that again, just rip it, ride it. And there were 30 authorized songs that Universal had, and you could literally, as you're standing in the queue, collect them and punch the numbers in, and that's the music that played for your seat. Mm-hmm. But the secret was that, again, this is a keypad-driven system, and there were 999 other tracks that, you know, if you keyed the right number, you got, for example, you could ride the ride to Rainbow Connection from the Muppets, which, of course, Universal doesn't own the rights to.
Oopsie.
You know, and again, it was a wonderful secret, but again, the problem is we live in the age of the web, and it leaked out, and there were artists that were genuinely flattered that they were on the secret list, and there were other artists who were horrified and sued, and so
really, that
kind of went away. But actually, we're just down toward the front of the park, and this is where Universal, again, Universal thinks about theme parks differently. One of the things when they built Rip Ride Rocket, you'll notice, all right, again, this goes all the way down to the front of the park. In fact, just on the edge of City Walk.
Yep.
All right?
Yeah, you can actually see part of it from City Walk, right?
Well, there's a reason for that, okay? Because if you go in through Blue Man Group, you will notice as you walk along it, there's actually a fence next to the coaster, and there's a gate that opens. And the plan, if they'd actually implemented, the plan was that even after Universal had closed for the night, they were going to offer people who were going to pay $2 a ride coming in off of City Walk to be able to get into the park to ride this thing.
Just that ride.
Just that ride. It was going to be an after hours, you know, you didn't have to wait for Universal to be open. You want to ride Rip It Rocket while you're here at City Walk, or you're catching the concert at the Hard Rock, you can do it.
$2 a ride is not bad.
Well, what ended up happening again is that the attorneys, the spoil sports, you know, kind of got in the way of it. And it may yet happen. I think part of the problem of this not going forward is anybody who's familiar with Rip Ride Rocket is they had an awful first year. They missed their opening date, and it, you know, by all as much as 5 months.
Wow.
And by then, you know, frankly, the company was kind of like, all right, just we'll put this off to the side here.
Well, we just want to get this thing up and running.
That's right. And now it's been eclipsed by Harry Potter. But it's an idea I hope they circle back on. So,
okay.
All right. Well, I think that, you know.
We're back at the entrance. It's a good place for us to start. Jim, thanks for touring Universal. We're going to head over to Islands of Adventure for the next podcast. We'll see you guys real soon. Thanks for listening.
Stupid Judy, stupid energy.
This has been a production of Mouse World Radio.
This podcast is sponsored by AAA, the American Automobile Association. AAA members get discounts on tickets, resort accommodations, and more at Walt Disney World and other Orlando attractions. If you book a qualifying Walt Disney World Resort vacation package at select AAA offices, you'll receive a free subscription to touringplans.com and dedicated trip planning resources just for AAA clients. Go to AAA.com or ask your local AAA travel agent for more details on this offer.